Welcome to the Heaven on Earth podcast, a world where you study the story you were born into and redesign it into the story you choose. A world where you can have heaven on earth right here, right now, no matter the past. For me, heaven on earth is a holistic experience, leading with the heart, engaging with mind, body, and spirit. It's mindful, fostering calm and secure attachments. As we rise into consciousness, it's an earthly journey where we sensually embrace dynamic living.
Charles Martinez! Yes! Welcome!
Thank you.
To the Heaven on Earth podcast. Today is such a gift to me because of how much we've journeyed together. We have been on this journey together for the last, I want to say, I think it's 23 years. So I feel like we were little when we met, and we've just slowly matured, grown up together professionally, personally, intimately. And I am just honored, and I treasure having you on this podcast because you're definitely part of my Heaven on Earth life.
Thank you. I'm honored. You're my treasure.
Yes. So much treasure. So much treasure. And let me just introduce you really quickly. I do read the intros because I can't memorize them. Just to let people know who you are living out there on the 3D world, what you do. So Charles, you're an experience like 14, 15 years, family nurse practitioner, and you completed your master's in nursing at Howard University. Mm-hmm. I remember this. I was there for this in 2013, and you've specialized in cardiology, although that broadened into holistic and integrative medicine and integrative health and mental health, which is one of our connections. And you do have multiple certifications in mind-body somatic practices, which is, of course, complete alignment, right? Complete alignment with mind-body spirit. So alongside or parallel to your clinical role, you have, in the last 2 years or maybe 3 years, you've been working in the psychedelic field with ketamine infusion therapy. And I need to read this one, stellate ganglion block, which I want you to talk about, injections. Mm-hmm. And this serves for people with PTSD. I definitely want you to touch on this topic because I think it's part of New Earth. And you are the clinical director and the clinic director and the nurse practitioner at Stella Center here in Washington, D.C. And that does a lot of ketamine treatments. You've lived in Washington, D.C. since 2002. I know that. And you also do holistic wellness coaching on the side as part of who you are and what you believe in. You have a commitment. I love commitment to unbiased, comprehensive care and personal growth. So you love empowering individuals, and you really do. Just with your beautiful gaze, you empower them. And your whole impetus is not only for your life, but to help others have a holistic wellness, personal development, living life. Yes, did I get that all? There's so much more to you, but that's at least your day job, right?
Thank you. Yes. You know, my love language is giving and helping. And it's been a beautiful journey and I'm privileged to make this a career because I wake up every morning loving what I do. And so it's just a beautiful thing.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah.
Yes. Isn't it amazing that one of our, you know, we talk about wealth from within, that one of our wealths from within is when we can actually align our craft, our work, what we do during the day for 8 hours, 9 hours, 10 hours a day with who we truly are. I mean, I think that's when that gap between what we're doing and who we're being starts to lessen and lessen and lessen. And that is definitely heaven on earth.
It is.
For
it is.
Sure.
You know, there was a guide once who introduced me to the meridian, you know, aligning that mind, body, peace aspect. Mm-hmm. And once that meridian line is connected, then that horizontal plane is also connected. So that horizontal plane is like your family and your colleagues and your relationships and your work and your religion, whatever ancillary is from the mind, body, spirit. And I was like, oh, it was like, yes, I get it. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And as you were describing that, I had this like image of, you know, it's almost like once we're aligned here in the meridian or this full chakra light up, it's almost like then we're radiating out is when this horizontal, it's like this radiating out to our families, to the people around us, to who we work with. So beautiful, beautiful. Charles, the way that I do this is I ask people to talk about what I call their volume one. And their volume one is the story that you were born into. Because what I like to track is the ways that your story of origin had these glimpses of who you are now. And then I follow it up with volume two, which is moments of awakening, moments, and that those might be awakening to pain or trauma or realizing that volume one was maybe more challenging than we thought. And then volume three is this heaven on earth life, which is the chosen life, the life that we are designing and creating. And I think that the whole planet is going through that process and moving it from old earth to new earth. So let's talk about your volume one.
You just saying that, like the planet moving into the new earth, I felt that. You know, it actually almost makes me want to cry where you can feel that energy, right? That energy of shift and what it could be with that shift.
Yes. What is it that you feel in the shift, Charles? You, what is it that you feel in that consciousness shift?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Planetary shift?
Well, first, what I innately feel is this calm in my gut. I think growing up, and we can start there. Growing up, I always have always had these feelings in my gut that were pretty spot on. I didn't know they were spot on. My intuition, right? The clairsentience or even the claircognizance. And we can talk more about the clairs later, but not knowing what the clairs were as a kid and even as an adult until I took one of your courses. Now I get it. Now I get it. I'm like, oh shoot. Like this little sensitive kid knew. Right? He knew. And I was a super sensitive kid growing up. Still am. Still a sensitive man. Where I could feel energy. And I didn't know what that really meant. I would have moments of just feeling. And I think, you know, growing up, you know, Latino and even Catholic, like there was no really talk about your feelings. I mean, my parents did a great job letting me be who I was. They gave me that autonomy to actually express and feel and stuff like that. But I'm talking on a deeper level. Even like if I had an out of body experience, let's say, for example, you know, if I were to tell my parents, my mom might have said, oh, well, you have a fever, right? And it was just her upbringing, like, oh, you're not feeling well. Maybe it's a fever. It was no, like, you know, just trying to justify why her son is feeling the way he is. So I just stopped expressing my feelings, right? Because I didn't want it to be labeled as a sickness or or something that was a negative connotation. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes. Keep going though. Yeah.
And and I'll give you one really great example. I was an altar boy. I think I was like 8 or 9 years old. And I was serving.
So this is sort of an environment of Latinos, Catholic Latinos is in New Mexico. This is, yes, pretty traditional.
Like a lot of my cousins were altar boys. A lot of my friends were altar boys and altar girls. You know, we called them altar servers. I mean, most of my friends were. In fact, they're still my friends today, people I served with in Mass. And it was Ash Wednesday, and I'll never forget. I was holding a candle for one of the readings. I think it was like the first reading. And I looked at the congregation and I saw everybody with like ashes on their forehead. And I was like, whoa. And I felt, and I have a point of being seen. So that will be later in my volumes. But I was being seen. People were looking at me with these ashes on their forehead. And as an 8-year-old kid, I felt afraid. I felt afraid that people were looking at me with these ashes on their forehead in this Mass, not fully understanding the dynamics of what Ash Wednesday was and being in Mass and being an altar boy. You know, you're 8 years old. You're doing what you're supposed to do or what maybe your parents want you to do. Or what society wants you to do, or what your religion wants to do. And then I left my body. And it might have been for 3 seconds. I don't know. It seemed like an eternity to me. But I remember leaving my body and looking down on me, looking at the congregation, and feeling really, really afraid. And after Mass, I went home, and I think I cried, and I asked my parents, you know, I was like, can I do something else besides be an altar boy? That was like a scary experience. And my parents were so loving that they've always given me the autonomy to speak up and do whatever I feels good. And they were like, sure, what do you want to do? And so it was a beautiful moment of me following my gut, following my feelings, because I was really scared. I was really scared, and it scared me so that I had the courage enough to actually tell my parents that this was a scary moment for me.
Well, and it's beautiful that you landed with parents who saw you, didn't insist or force you to continue, because that's part of the, it's like a self-love. It's a securely attached place to land. Even if they might have not understood, they were like, absolutely, what are you wanting to do?
And, but I will say, though, I did not tell them I left my body. I didn't tell them that part. I left that part out. I just said I was scared in church. I didn't want to do it anymore. It was such a profound moment of my intuition, of my knowing.
When you look back on that right now, Charles, what do you think you knew? Like what, when, you know, as this adult, more conscious man, what did you think you knew in that environment?
That I didn't want it. That I didn't want it. I felt afraid of the situation. And that will play a role later in my life, is ignoring sometimes that gut feeling out of fear or resistance or being unprocessed, all of that, right? Like all of that. I think as an 8-year-old kid, I was still so fresh in the world. I was so fresh in the world that there wasn't... Yes. There wasn't all these clouds coming at me, or even insecurities coming at me. Because think about when you're 8 or 7, 6, like you're not insecure. You'll run around naked. You just like So
yes, that self-consciousness, it is like sort of the opening of consciousness, self-consciousness, but not yet.
Not yet.
Charles, can you say a little bit more? Because I do want to leverage the opportunity of what it meant or even means to be a sensitive male, although there's more language and more culture for it today, definitely. But, you know, this I think is like the 1980s. What did that mean? What did it mean to be sensitive and to pair that with being a boy? And, you know, if we keep layering it, a Latin boy, what have you been able to piece together about being sensitive?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think being male and being sensitive comes with stigma as a kid. You know, there's this false narrative of little boys being tough and macho and you're not supposed to cry. And I was a crier and my parents were like, they never suppressed that. Thank God. Like, thank you. They let me feel right. I keep saying that because it's true. But still outside of the home, you didn't want to look as weak in front of your friends who may tease you for being sensitive. I remember my entire life, I've always had like a lot of friends. I've been extroverted. But when I think about it, I always had at least one friend that I was intimate with, like intimate of in the sense of it was that one-on-one conversation or playing or where I really enjoyed because I got to fully feel them without distraction. And I really liked it.
Beautiful definition.
I really liked it. I liked the one-on-one. Yes, friends were fun, like hanging out and stuff. But the one-on-one for me, it was like juicy. It was like, yes, like depth. I didn't realize it then. This is years later as an adult where I'm like, I really enjoy one-on-one intimacy and depth. It fuels my soul. And I think as a kid, that sensitivity, I don't know, was not present with everyone, with my male friends. And so I shied away from it a lot.
Right. So would you say that the way that sensitivity showed up, because we want to nuance it again, it's almost like intuition was this desire to be like soul close to somebody, like with our souls and to go deeply with somebody. Are you describing that as sensitivity, which right now, as you're talking about it, it sounds like there was a way you felt a little off or a little weird. I want to spend more deep time with this person.
And it didn't matter if it was a boy or girl. Like it was just, it was the feeling of that person.
Wanting to be that attached. Yes. What other examples, or maybe one other example of knowing about this sensitivity that actually has no gender?
Yeah.
Of wanting something, or of knowing that you couldn't be sensitive, let's say, in the world, like crying or expressing fear.
Well, definitely crying is a given, although I cry in the household, which is fine, but crying out in public was never, I never did that. I never wanted to be seen as weak. But I will say one thing about gender is that I did connect more with girls. I did. because they were more sensitive, right? And I remember having a lot of girlfriends and being teased for it, you know, being called, you know, like, you know, gay or a girly boy or even a pretty boy at one point. But I was like, what the hell? Like, it's a connection. Like, I didn't see it as a gender thing. I saw it as a connection, but subconsciously, I didn't know that. Like, I didn't know it was not a gender thing. Now I know that it wasn't a gender thing. It was like, it was a connection thing. Because I'm a connector. I love connection. Whether it's with people, with animals, with the environment, like I like connection. I'm not sure if I've answered your question or not, but as far as the sensitivity piece, yeah, I did try to be more macho in public, for sure. You know, growing up where I grew up, like little boys are macho, you know? They're,
where did you grow up? Can you tell?
Yeah, I grew up in northern New Mexico. New Mexico is just, talk about spirituality.
Yes, the land of enchantment for sure. There's literally the moment you get off a plane in New Mexico, you can feel that the frequency is so
I always tell people when I go to New Mexico and when I land and when I walk on the land, you can feel the indigenous wisdom. You can feel the indigenous love and energy and spirituality. It's my favorite place on earth. It really is. And I may be biased. It's my home. But no, people who go there will feel it. They'll feel it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think it's biased at all. It's really true. And New Mexicans, they're a very particular people. Yeah. Really, or the way that I have felt connections with New Mexicans and there's so much combination.
And I'm still connected to a ton of like childhood friends who I actually communicate with a lot, you know. So it's home. It's home. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is one of your qualities that you do stay connected for the long run. There is a quality, and I know this about you through our friendship, this connected commitment that you stay committed if you choose, right? If you choose, because there's people I know that you've cut cords with and those were conscious decisions. But when you decide to stay in, you stay all in, which is of course part of your empath nature as well, which part of this is foreshadowing or the spoiler alert that you're quite a high empath for sure.
Which can lead, which my next point of being sensitive in the world is because I was such a kind kid, I think people may have taken it for weakness. And even as an adult, being taken advantage of for my kindness and not to woo me at all, but more to now understand that I can actually set some boundaries around that I didn't know as a kid. And even as an adult, even as a mid-40s adult, learning that every single day to set these boundaries that myself as an empath can be completely walked over on, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, we end up being very depleted if we don't have like what I call we keep alive the kind heart, we keep it alive. Because I think, you know, sometimes if we've been taken advantage of and used and abused, because that does happen, there's a woundedness sometimes to our story most of the time. But learning how to stay committed to the kind heart with what I call like a parameter and a perimeter. It's not a way really of rejecting anyone. It's just a way of putting a parameter around our heart and a perimeter around our heart. And that allows us to be choosers. We choose. We consciously choose who comes in.
Yeah.
Now, does that resonate with you?
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about your volume 2. So this little sensitive boy is having, and let me be clear about that church experience. So some people might say, well, clinically, that's a dissociative moment, right? And meaning most people or most children, when they feel afraid, or even adults, if they feel afraid, they can dissociate. And I talk a lot about that when I'm teaching about empaths. Like, yes, that's true. That's the clinical word for it. Spiritually, I think that our body knows and our spirit knows and our higher consciousness or higher self knows that sometimes our little psyche, our little body can't tolerate what's happening in the moment. And we do leave our bodies, and certainly empaths leave their bodies all the time. And we can get into that more, but I want to connect that it's, you know, in this multilingual way that I like to work, and you know this, Charles, is that clinically, yes, it's a dissociative moment, but it's also this moment where our higher consciousness knows that this is a moment that we can be self-observing. And I think we get intuitive hits in those moments when we leave our body. So really important to underscore.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's just one of many for me. Right. Mm-hmm.
Of moments where you felt like you were observing yourself from the outside. Mm-hmm. Do you want to share more?
Well, I mean, that kind of takes us into volume two, where what changed for me, what really changed for me, mind, body, spirit, and who I was in, how about who I was born to be in this world truly, right? Viscerally, innately. But my volume two, I didn't know this was volume two. I didn't know this was volume two.
Most of us don't, right? I've just framed it this way, but yes.
So volume two started in April 2002. I was violently assaulted. Violently. And I may get a little emotional only because I've never actually talked about this publicly. Like, never, right?
So we're going to put a circle of love and light around.
Thank you. Okay. And I'm not stopping myself from crying. I want to get the message out. So in April 7th, 2002, my sister and I threw a really cool surprise birthday party for my father in our hometown. And we had a great night. Tons of family and friends came in for this party. It was a surprise birthday party. My dad had never had a surprise birthday party. He was through the moon. All his friends and family came out to celebrate him. And you know my dad. He's just fun. He's a good guy. He's lovable. He's so darn cute. And after the party, some friends and I who actually came to the party, some friends that lived out of town actually came in for the party, wanted to hang out. And I was like, oh, cool. Yes. And my mom's an empath, and my mom has this intuitive power that she has no idea she has. And she said, don't go out, honey. Like, stay with us at home. Let's just hang out. Don't go out. I was like, oh, mom, you know, I was 23 at the time. Like, mom, just, I'll be back. You know, I'll come back and we'll make breakfast when I get home, blah, blah, you know. In the morning, we'll make breakfast, whatever, we'll hang out. So I left and I met up with some friends less than a mile from home, like maybe half a mile from my childhood home. And I was walking into this apartment. I got in my car and I was walking towards the apartment, and there were these two guys in a car. And they asked me a question, and I didn't understand what their question was. And they asked for a person, and I didn't know who that person was, but I had this feeling. It was almost the similar feeling I had in my gut when I was 8 years old in Mass. And my entire body just said, Charles, walk away. But there was another message that said, be careful, though, walking away. Like, be careful. ignored the be careful part, and I just walked away. Didn't engage with them. And the next thing I heard was someone say, "Charles, watch out," or something to that effect. And so I turned around and I just see this menace with a wooden baseball bat. It was very, very quick. And I felt the impact on my head. And like the world went crimson. And ringing in my ears, similar to watching the movie and hearing that flatline sound when someone flatlines in the hospital, like that alarm sound in my ears. And I remember being on the ground and I'm like crawling, like trying to figure out what's happening in my world. And at the same time as I'm crawling, trying to figure out what's going on, I feel like kicks, like to my stomach and to my head, to my back, to my entire body. I feel kicks. And then there was one point where I felt almost suffocated, where I felt someone straddling me. But it wasn't the assailant. It wasn't the guys who were attacking me. It was a really, really beautiful friend of mine, Felicia, who I'm still close with to this day. And at that moment, I left my body. I left my body again. And I was watching myself being attacked, but also protected by Felicia. And I'm not sure how long I was out of it. I never lost consciousness, though. I was pretty conscious the entire time, except for that one moment of leaving my body and observing this trauma. And the next thing I remember is I get up.
Felicia was straddling you to protect you.
She was covering my face, protecting me. And like I could hear screaming, like, "Get off him, get off him." And then I heard my other friends who were male. They were in the apartment, heard the scuffle, then came out and like chased the guys away. And then I remember like walking to the apartment and being inside the apartment, like blood on my hands, consciously being embarrassed that I have blood on the carpet of my friend's home, and apologizing to him, like, "Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Like, I will clean this up for you." Walking to the bathroom, and I can't remember what friend walked in, asked if I needed help. I said, no, I'm good. I said, "Just get me like a Band-Aid." Not knowing, you know, the trauma that I had just sustained to my skull, my frontal lobe, my eye. And I look in the mirror and I see my skull and I see a gash, like, you know, big gash. And I still just want a Band-Aid. And a friend was like, "We need to call 911. I said, "Oh my God, don't call 911. How embarrassing." Like, how embarrassing. And looking back,
what was the embarrassment? Like, I know it's sort of the wounded empath impulse to make sure everyone else is okay. I mean, that's what you were doing, making sure that everyone else was okay.
I didn't want to burden anyone.
That was the embarrassment.
That was embarrassing.
Yes.
And my friend Josh says, "We need to call the ambulance." I said, "No." I was like, "I'll agree to go to the hospital, but just put me in the back of the truck so I don't get blood on my dad's seat." Like, he lent me his truck that night. I said, "Put me in the back of the truck." So Josh and another friend drove me to the hospital. And I'm still conscious and I'm in the hospital. And I'm in the emergency room. And the nurse says, "We need to cut your shirt and your pants. We need to get you undressed." I said, "No." I said, "I just bought these clothes for my dad's party. Don't cut them. I'll take them off." I felt embarrassed, right? Just that people had to help me.
Well, and you weren't aware of the gravity of what was happening to you.
No.
That you basically, your head was cracked open. Yeah.
And then my sister gets there. I'm not sure how she found out. She gets there. And I remember crying to her and just saying, "Don't tell mom and dad. I don't want to hurt them. I don't want them to see me." And I remember like vomiting like coffee ground, textures of like coffee grounds, which was blood because I was bleeding internally. And then I wake up days later in a hospital. So long story short, I spent a lot of time in the hospital in an induced coma. Several subdural hematomas to the right side of my brain. But I am so grateful for that moment, which starts my volume two. I mean, I was literally a human piñata that opened up so many treasures.
Wow. I mean, I'm right now feeling it in my body. What? How are you experiencing it as you're describing it? Because I'm really wanting to hold space for you as you give this detail to really such a wound.
Thank you. Yeah. I feel sad for Charles at 23. I have a lot of emotions, right? I feel sad. I feel grateful. I feel a little relief right now, just kind of letting that out, like publicly speaking about it, which I haven't done. And I haven't done it publicly for many reasons. One, I'm always in fear of like my family seeing this and having to relive that. Because I feel like as much as I endured this trauma, viscerally, I felt more protective of my parents having to witness their child almost dying, right?
Right, because it was hit or miss for
it was. They didn't know if I was going to make it, and if I did make it, they didn't know if I was going to have a brain injury and what rehabilitation looked like for me. You know, I had to take off of work, and my parents took off from work. Like, there were just so many things that impacted us in that year. To heal. So I never really spoke publicly because I didn't want my parents to kind of relive that. It was scary and it was hurtful. And that's me being the empath, right? Worrying about other people.
It is. I don't want to take away from the intensity of what you're saying by actually adding the whole time the empath in you is, again, constantly protecting those around you, including in this moment, even though it was you who was going through this. It's that combination of the kind heart and caring for others more than oneself. Mm. Although that starts to transmute, right? Yes. So you're grateful. Like I always say that one of the things about heaven on earth is that our wounds become our gifts. Mm-hmm. And so you talking about it as a piñata, can you say some more about this alchemy of this horrible, horrible event?
You know, it opened, when I say it opened up a ton of treasures, it did. It actually changed the trajectory of my career. You know, the nurses in the hospital took such good care of me. They were the backbone of my healing. They were kind. You know, obviously they were administering medication, but also like the bed baths, the all of it, the kindness, the encouragement. And so years later, it took me a while.
The tenderness.
Tenderness, compassion.
So much. Yes.
Empathy.
Yes.
And it was never sympathy. It was empathy. There's a big difference. Like they didn't feel bad for me. They were like, no, like, come on. Like they were really, really feeling me and they were tender and just warm. They were warm. And so years later, I end up, you know, going into the nursing field. I thought medical school, I was on that track. Like I'm going to go to medical school. And then I sat with that and I felt that, and that felt it, that felt all heady. That was all executive function, right? That was all like prefrontal cortex crap. Where the nursing was more limbic. Like I actually felt the nursing in my limbic system. Like that's what I wanted to do. And I did it. I did it. You know, I went to nursing school, ended up wanting to have more autonomy for my patients and ended up going for my master's to become a nurse practitioner. And that was just one treasure. Another treasure was moving to DC. You know, I had spent a couple of summers here during college and fell in love with DC. But it was also a place where I could be far away from my family to discover who Charles really was. And not that this part of me defines me at all. It's just another part of me, right, is being gay and coming out of the closet.
Right? Yes.
Because life was too short at that point. I was like, life is way too short. Why am I not living my truth? My every truth, not just being gay, my truth, my intimacy, my sensitivity, my giving, like all the geniuses you talk about, that you've taught me to acknowledge about me, why not express that and have that and be sovereign about me, Charles Martinez? Like, why not?
Did you feel like an uncanny clarity?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But it still took a while. Like, that was just the tip of the iceberg, right? Like, there was still more healing to... Yeah, there was just still more healing to do in that. And then I meet you, right? I meet you in November of that year of 2002. So I got hurt in April, took months and months to heal, really a full year. Even though I moved to DC, I was still healing from the assault. But then I meet you in November. And how this comes full circle is that I felt you. When I met you, I felt you. I mean, you have your narrative. I have my narrative. My narrative is that I wanted to be your friend. And you were like this young mom, you know, with this 2-year-old gorgeous son.
I had a baby. You were just this 23-year-old new guy in DC. Yeah, we were just in, or how about this? It felt like on the external plane that we were in different places, at least to me.
And we probably were. But I felt you. I felt you. And I wanted intimacy with you. I wanted to connect with you. And there's that connection again. I wanted to connect with you. And, you know, I know we always joke around about this, but I like chased you to hang out with you. And finally you said, okay, right? And then here we are.
There was a knowingness that you had. I didn't have it at the time, but you definitely had it. And again, it just tracks. It keeps tracking that you have these moments of knowingness. Some of them you haven't listened to, and some of them you've actually fully pursued.
Yeah, your energy and who you are to this world, even before you embarked on your volumes, I felt the meridian with you. I felt it. And I'm so grateful that I listened to myself. Because I don't always listen to myself.
Yes.
And that was a moment of just pure gift for me, was meeting you.
Why is that? And like, because... And I'm not so, I mean, of course, I want you to talk about our connection and our intimacy and our commitment. But I know that what began to sort of unravel for you was really a deeper knowing of you, of it, like that was the beginning of your journey of intimacy with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you say something about that or more about these moments of your life starting to unfold?
You know, I was more conscious of who I wanted to be around, mm-hmm. and the things that I wanted to do. And I found myself meeting people along the way who I connected with spiritually, intimately, and it felt really good in that nervous system, in my nervous system. I still fumbled along the way a ton of times.
23? Fumbled, 20s? Are you kidding me? 30s?
And fumbled. But
sure, that's part of
but
it.
But each fumble, I always got higher. That frequency, my frequency always got just a little bit higher and just a little bit higher and just a little bit higher. And you were a big, 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 big part of fostering that frequency for me. I mean, this is why, I'm not sure if this is a good transition, but this is why I got into the psychedelic world. Because of you, you know, I did my own personal journey to healing. And once I realized who I was on this personal level, I knew that my job, my career, ancillary to me had to be parallel. Had yes. to be parallel. And that's why I embarked on the psychedelic journey as a career of what I'm doing today with like ketamine and even somatic practices, whether it be breath work, whatever, right? Like I knew that it had to be aligned. There was no other way. And I loved my health career in cardiology and all that. Like I loved helping people, but I ended up starting to lose myself after the pandemic in caring for people because it was just too much. There wasn't time to treat them properly. There wasn't time for connection with your patients. There wasn't time for conversation. There wasn't even time for proper healing. It was just like a factory, like moving from one patient to the next. And then I felt myself resenting me. Not my patients, resenting me, because I couldn't fully treat them like I wanted to treat them. Like I've always treated my patients with kindness and respect and a listener.
And time.
And time.
Right, which is an abundance code. Time, giving them time. But what's interesting to me is the paradox that you were working in cardiology with the heart, but what you're describing are signals and symptoms of not working with your heart, where it becomes something else. It becomes, you know, whether it's pleasing the system you're working in or using the mind too much, when the mind is over here and the heart is over here, or maybe you felt like you couldn't be working with your heart because you just had to turn patients mm-hmm. over. So it's like the heart starts to become left behind. And here you are working in cardiology. And we know, I mean, if we work holistically, that so many issues of the heart is about forgetting our heart, forgetting our in love mm-hmm. heart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Charles, I absolutely want you to describe your journey with psychedelics and how you see this in New Earth and the healing of the earth and the healing of humanity. These are big topics, but I certainly hold that going back to psychedelics, because they were in our human history they've been in our human history for a very long time with indigenous peoples, etc. Before we go into that, can you describe other moments in your volume 2, even if it's towards the end, of you having moments of awakening? One, it sounds like, you know, that you were committed to fully coming out of the closet, your connection with me and people like me. It sounds like becoming a nurse came straight from the inside. What other moments were you, even if they weren't good ones, even if they were like, oh, that is an awakening because I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. I'm not, because sometimes our awakenings, huh, yeah. Charles, our awakening moments is actually having an experience of contrast, of knowing what you don't want, actually. Of really being clear and just of U-turns that we take where we're like,
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. So one profound and beautiful gift that also came out of this was creating boundaries. And I know I talked about that earlier, but for me, it was creating boundaries with folks who didn't give me what I gave them. One, for example, is surrounding myself with people who only bring me joy, curiosity, and growth. And it doesn't have to be all three. It can be one or the other. If it's all three, amazing.
Joy, curiosity, and growth.
Joy, curiosity, and growth.
Those are your markers. Relational markers.
Those are my markers. Those are my markers. Mm-hmm. And that even comes with the job. If the job doesn't bring me curiosity, joy, or growth, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. And that even goes as far as what I put into my body, the food I eat. If it doesn't bring me those three either, now, of course, I cheat. You know, I'm human. However, you have to reward yourself too, right? You have to reward yourself. But with my surroundings, the people I choose to hang out with, I'm sovereign about. And I've had to let go of really close relationships with people I thought were best friends, even family members. As hard as that was, even family members.
Sure.
But I had to remain respectful and sovereign to me, to my spirit. And I learned this term from you, the shadow contracts. You know, not having these shadow contracts. Like, don't do something out of guilt. And that goes as far as, and you use this as an example, right? If someone calls you and you miss the call and you need to call them back, are you calling them back out of guilt or are you calling them back because you really want to connect with them? All right, that's just an example of that shadow contract that you taught us. And so I try my hardest to live by that. Like, I don't want these shadow contracts. And in turn, I don't want to put myself in a situation where I'm going to feel bad for doing something. And that goes along with hanging out with people that I don't want to hang out with. Right. So I do feel like as I get older, I do like this intimacy with people. And maybe my circle of friends have gotten a little smaller, but I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that.
So let's say a little bit about, just for people who will listen to us or share this podcast, about shadow contracts and the idea of the shadow contract. I know that Amanda Flaker talks about it. Teal Swan talks about it. And Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst Carl Jung, talked about the shadow, right? And oh, remember you sent me a long program on discovering the shadow. And in psychotherapy, we really talk about integrating the shadow, like what shadow aspects are in us that we're not paying attention to, but will play out. I say they're stalkers and lurkers and ambushers, because they're going to show up. Our shadow sides will show up and ambush us, and they're lurking.
Leakage, right? That's the leakage. That's
correct. Right. They'll show up and get our attention until we integrate them. But the shadow contracts are agreements, silent agreements that we make with people and that are based on fear, guilt, and shame. And this, of course, can absolutely, most of us, most of our cultures and our family systems have that, even with our family. It's not just our colleagues or someone random that we have shadow agreements with. We have them with our lovers, with our partners, with our parents, with our children. Anything where we're having these feelings of fear, you know, I better do this because I'll get in trouble, because I'll look bad. Because they might retaliate. Those are all fear contracts. Or guilt contracts, and families are rife with guilt contracts. Well, I raised you. So now it's your turn to be beholden to me, any type of feelings of beholdenness or obligations, which doesn't mean that we don't grow up with tradition. It's like, how do we transmute our feelings from obligation, duty, guilt? How do we do that and convert it into something else? Again, the wound becoming the gift, right? And then anything based on shame. Shame.
Shame is so heavy.
Shame is, it's one of the hardest. I always call it like that gooey stuff that's in the oven. You know that, you know how hard it is to clean an oven because there's this resin, and shame is like that. But I always thank when shame shows up because it actually allows us to say, I'm not going to do this anymore. Of course, like alcoholic families, abusive families, places where we grow up with feeling ashamed of ourselves or where we grow up. So it's, you know, those, and that this is an arduous process, isn't it, Charles, to cut these cords and painful, and to notice that we've got shadow contracts going with maybe people we deeply love. Would you agree with that?
Wholeheartedly. It's so fearful. It's so fearful because we fear loss and we fear lack. That lack matrix. I think you and Amanda Flaker talk about the lack matrix. It gets so real.
Well, the lack matrix is runs on shadow contracts. Right. It basically, the whole system is based on shadow contracts, which is how, what are the ways that we as a collective are afraid, are ashamed? So let's say of our credit report, of not having money, right? That there is a collective consciousness that tells us we should be afraid, we should be ashamed, and we should have guilt. So the lack matrix is all about living off of those three precise feelings, right?
You just which
is
saying when that gave me heartburn. I promise you, you just saying that, I felt the acidity in my system.
And what can you connect with if we actually just do like a somatic moment right now? Like,
yeah.
What comes up there? Is it stress or is it a memory or?
It feels like futuristic. It feels like what could happen.
Yes.
So that worrying about the future, right? And not staying present. It's easier said than done to stay present. And we always say that, like, just be present, be present. Look, we live in this 3D world where the news or your friends or family, they scare you. They scare you. And so it's the anticipation of when's the next shoe going to drop?
Yes. And that's a formula, right, that we've got going. So I do want to hold you, and I want to hold anyone who's listening to us around shadow contracts. Listen, we are in an upheaval on the planet where many, many people, just like you, Charles, like me for sure, are becoming so aware of our shadow contracts with our work, with our career. Lots of people are leaving what they were trained to do. Lots of people are deciding not to go back to college. Lots of people are saying, I can't do one more Thanksgiving because we're all faking it. And that's really, really painful. But I cannot continue to live in those type of relational agreements. So it's not just you that are doing this very hard work of facing their shadow agreements with others, with the system, with their work, with their self. Because sometimes we have a shadow contract with ourselves. It's so scary to sometimes face things about ourselves. So one thing I want to say is we do not do this alone. Mm-hmm. We find others like you and me. We find therapists and groups and 12-step programs. My commitment is that we do not do this alone. There's lots of people who've done this that are ahead of us. Mm. Lots of people who are behind us that we can show them that this is doable. And we have so many more tools and processes today.
Yes.
And we have a connection with the divine if we believe in that. But how about this? With law of attraction, with the quantum field, doesn't matter. But that there is something available to us in our higher consciousness, our higher self, that like you, your examples, speaks to us, tells us to not be afraid. So just as you were feeling that, even if you have some fear, Charles, of more shadow contracts that you have to face, as all of us do, know that it's, don't do it alone.
I like when you said the whole quantum physics thing, because, you know, quantum meaning how much, right? How much? Like there's just so much in our world that we don't even acknowledge or recognize, like our gifts. A friend of mine sent me this, she sent me this TED Talk, but I actually saw this 2 years ago and I completely forgot about it. And it was a TED Talk with Emily Levine. She was like an American humorist. She was a public speaker, and she talked on about like the science and the human condition. And she talked about like she had stage four cancer, lung cancer, and she was talking about how she wasn't afraid of dying, right? And she said that what's extraordinary about life is that it's a cycle of generation, degeneration, regeneration. And when I think about that, like in a holistic way, I feel like that's who we are in this world. That's our energy. Our energy is a cycle of generation, degeneration, regeneration. And we can always change our narrative. And I think that that's what psychedelics do for us. That's what psychedelics can do for us.
Let's change
the narrative.
Volume 3.
Change the narrative of our trauma. Right.
Say more about that process. So
the idea with psychedelics and neuroplasticity meaning the new creation of neural pathways in the brain that makes different connections. So, for example, ketamine. I work with ketamine. It's a disassociative anesthetic that was used for anesthesia, like in the 60s, especially for our soldiers, that they could be operated on the battlefield without having to be intubated, to worry about their breathing, because ketamine is such a safe kind of anesthetic. They use it on kids all the time for surgeries. Mm-hmm. What they found was that ketamine mitigates our neurotransmitter receptors, specifically the glutamate neurotransmitter receptors. And what these soldiers were feeling were they were having these like out-of-body experiences while under, where they were leaving their body and looking inside the body and deconstructing their trauma. And they were coming out of it elated. And so fast forward to today, I mean, this is now ketamine's a big thing in our world for psychedelic therapy. And so we can now help folks who have PTSD, anxiety, depression, or treatment-resistant depression, more specifically, people who have taken SSRIs that aren't working, and we're treating them with this modality where we infuse them with ketamine and they're guided, you know, that there's someone there, but they have this experience where they can look inside their self and open up these doors to healing. And so maybe they have an intention, because I'll say just kind of in general or arbitrary intention of like, I want peace in life. But what happens sometimes is that they can have this subconscious intention come to fruition that they may be buried when they were 10 years old. Right?
deeply in the unconscious, something like
deeply in the unconscious, and have this experience with it, or they might have ancestral trauma. Mm-hmm. I had this one client who she didn't know why she was anxious. And she's been anxious for years. You know, she couldn't identify a specific trauma in her life. Long story short, it turned out that she was carrying the grief of her grandfather who survived the Holocaust. So that's just one of many examples of what this work can help folks uncover. You know, and the one big piece around psychedelic therapy is having a trained professional like yourself, a therapist, who can integrate your experiences, who can integrate that journey you had within. You know, so I don't want to say that psychedelic therapy is a cure for anything. It's a tool, just like anything else. But if you can use that tool and work within yourself to unpack whatever needs to be unpacking with a licensed professional, it could be a really beautiful thing. And I've seen it happen.
It's happened with me. I'm
walking living proof. This is why I'm doing this.
You've had some treatment yourself, right?
And it's been a beautiful journey.
Right? Yes.
But you have to do it responsibly. I have to say that.
Yes, for sure. And Charles, the way I like to talk about it, I like talking about neuroplasticity as like a hope discovery, like just giving it that word neuroplasticity, because basically, and I love the visual. For me, the visual is that our mind has these rigid neural nets, neural pathways that have been formed with our narrative, with our stories, with our trauma. And it's almost just clamps down. And so what I like to call the mind blowing experiences, any experiences that just blow our mind. And that could be like seeing the Northern Lights in Iceland or actually falling in love when you thought you'd never fall in love, but psychedelics in particular, I think, allows for the mind to just unfurl from those rigid narratives, neural nets, open up. Mm-hmm. And what I like to tell people that in psychedelic psychotherapy, what we're able to do is, first of all, see that mind open up. And psychedelics have just this beautiful way, ketamine, of bringing up trauma in such a kind way. It doesn't mean it's not hard to see, because I've had my own experience. Some of the stuff that comes up that you're like, I didn't even know that was there. Extremely buried memories. And this has been in my own experience and experience with clients. It brings it up in this way that permits us to actually look at it. And then as the mind, I think, is neuroplastic and soft, that's where we can come in and treat and integrate and say, how do you want to look at this now? How do you want to reintegrate it into our body? What was the word that you regenerated? Mm-hmm. How do we want, right? So let's use the word alchemy, transmutation, transformation, renaissance, because of course this leads us into a renaissance, into being reborn. So just coming in and tinkering and having access to the unconscious through psychedelic psychotherapy has been, for me, I think it is just part of New Earth.
It really is. And you know, and you can do this work outside of psychedelic breath work, you know, meditation, which you teach beautifully, the active meditation that you teach.
Yes.
You know, the difference between the passive and the active. The active is, you know, practical and portable, and you can do it when you're driving. Passive, it's like sitting in a room saying om, right? There's just so many modalities out there that can help with neuroplasticity, with help regenerating these new pathways to health, to seriously holistic well-being. But it comes with intention.
Go ahead.
Right? Being intentional about wanting to heal. And that's with who you hang out with, what you put in your body when you eat, like exercising, all of that is holistic.
Yes. Yes, it's mind, body, spirit. I feel so inspired as you're speaking. I was going to say teaching, but as you're speaking, Charles, because I can really feel, you know, I talk about one of the markers of heaven on earth is a calm central nervous system. So not only are we talking about tools and processes that aid us in calming our central nervous system, first, because the trauma starts to leave our body in a different way. We allow it to leave our body. But also, I can feel it in you. I can feel how much calmer your central nervous system is. And that in itself radiates calm. Mm. And you know,
thank you for absolutely. Witnessing that. Thank you for witnessing
yes. that. Cause I've felt you throughout the years, and it really also underscores what we've been saying, which is like heal yourself, heal the planet, my dynamic little tagline, which is just someone's presence. And I've seen you at work with clients, with patients in your home. I've seen you at work and certainly with your friends that you radiate a calm central nervous system.
Yeah. I think a lot of this, which kind of bridges my volume 2 and volume 3 is being seen in the world, right? Like, who am I in the world? And being seen for who I am without feeling bad about who I am. Like, just doing this podcast with you, it's a little nerve-wracking, and I'm working through that. Like, being seen, like, not knowing who's going to see this, who's going to judge, all of that. Just being seen in the world. And I think a lot of people can resonate with that, like, being seen in the world is scary. That's why I always I'm always in awe of like actors or even television personality people or even TikTok people. It's a lot. You've had this big platform now. You're having this big platform, and it's like I'm so grateful to witness you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Right. It is part of what puts us as a humanity in a hypervigilant state is this sort of what I call like sort of this global gladiator coliseum where people are going like, not like they send you to their to your psychic death by not liking you. And that part of it is to still say and still commit to showing. To keep moving forward, especially if we have messaging that can be healing and that can provide us with some ideas, new neural nets for a new type of world and a new way of living, Charles. So part of why I wanted to invite you is because in your life, you're actively doing that all day long. At home and in your work.
You know, we as humans live, and even animals, we live in this fight or flight cave. And it's all the time, whether you're watching news or in traffic or even in session, right? Like, our fight or flight is always here. Right? So the body starts to just adapt to this fight or flight, which then causes anxiety. So you're living in this fight or flight system all the time. Cortisol level shoots up. And then what happens? Disease happens in our body.
Sure. So
dis-ease. And it's real. And then autoimmune diseases start to happen and all cancer. So when your body is always just tensed up, your body's going to attack itself.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
In fact, speaking of fight or flight, you know, we do have this other procedure at Stella Center. It's what you mentioned earlier, the stellate ganglion block, where we basically reset.
Tell me more about that. Yes.
We basically reset the sympathetic system. So what they do is it's ultrasound guided by an anesthesiologist. And they go in through the C4 and C6 in your neck and they inject this nerve block. And it's about a 10 to 15 minute procedure. And it resets the sympathetic system. And clients who get this done, who have like complex PTSD, you know, highly, highly anxious because of trauma. The analogy they use is after the procedure, it feels like you're being hugged without any distraction or stress or anxiety. There's this ease about their spirit that feels scary for them because they're always here. And then all of a sudden, there's homeostasis. There's this balance. And it feels emotional for some folks. That's a whole other podcast. Like, we could discuss that.
I want people to know about this. Let me tell you why. Although that procedure sounds scary, but it's not, because, you know, injecting in the neck, it's not scary, actually. It is a complete reset that's doing wonders for vets.
It is.
Who are doing wonder for suicidal vets. So I want this information out there, Charles, because I think there's so many roads to heaven on earth. And heaven on earth is the possibility of having a vibrant, safe, stable life again. It is here now, heaven on earth. And things like ketamine treatments and SGB, is it called? Yeah, SGB. And psychedelic psychotherapy and setting intentions and integrating, like, these are the discussions that we need to have that start paving the infrastructure of a life that can be well lived, no matter what you've been through.
Absolutely.
That is my mission. Charles, can I ask you a little bit, and we're going to end really soon, which is what are your thoughts about New Earth and heaven on earth? You're on the podcast, so I know that you're a believer, but tell me why, and tell me what you believe about it.
Gosh, that's a really loaded question. And I feel like I'm starting to live it. Like, this is heaven on earth. My spirit is heaven on earth. Your spirit is heaven on earth. The people who you and I surround ourselves with is New Earth, is heaven on earth. You know, I think that, I think if anybody hears that term heaven on earth, I don't know if their mind goes religion first. Mm-hmm. Sure. And it can, but it's grander than that, right? It's grander than religion. It's grander than education. It's grander than our family. It's like I have this image of grounding. Like, heaven on earth seems so far up. And for me, it actually feels so grounding, right? It feels like solid, supported.
I am here now.
I'm here now.
Yes.
And I will be so present in the now. And whatever that means for you, we have different, you know, it can mean different for everyone. But for me, it's that meridian. It's that mind-body peace. And it's okay to fall off, you know, the plane, but coming back right? Because we're human. We're going to fall off the plane.
Yes.
But being intentional about coming back to that plane, right? That vertical line, so that our horizontal line can just also follow suit. So,
beautiful. Well, Charles, I do want to announce that we are co-authoring a book, which is the Empath Leader book. And those are some of the people that you're describing that we surround ourselves with empaths who are healing. And people who are really on this journey of knowing themselves, of self-discovery, of wanting to create a new world together through connected adult bonds of secure attachment, all of that. And part of the another leg in our journey together is that we're co-authoring the Empath Leader book. So I can't wait. It's coming out next year and we're going to let people know, but I am just so proud and honored that you are one of the authors and you're an empath leader. Obviously, look at everything that you did, and you've been an empath all your life. And now you're just using it for the healing of the world and of yourself, for sure.
Well, Claudia, thank you for one, being an amazing friend, teacher, mentor. Thank God I bugged the crap out of you when I was 23. I'm your friend. But honestly, in all seriousness, and just thank you for inviting me to co-author this book. Thank you for inviting me to this podcast. Thank you for allowing me to be witnessed and allowing me to witness you. It's a special, special bond. And I'm just so grateful for you and for your presence and your gift to this new earth, to heaven on earth.
Thank you. We're on that road together.
Yeah.
We're a metaphor. Mm. We are a symbol of what it can be. So I'm going to ask everyone, hey, if you want to join Charles and me on this heaven on earth mission, share, subscribe, spread the word, because I really want this word out, that we can have this type of life here and now, no matter what's happened to us. And there's lots of ways to do it. So Charles, thank you so much. This will not be your last time on the podcast. And the way that I end the podcast is, let's take three deep breaths together so that we become aligned, but we're also in our energetic fields together. And so if you can just lean back into your back body and take a deep breath. And out and in and out. And anyone who's watching it, do it with us, and you'll be in our energetic fields. And in. And I like a deep yes hail where I just say yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you.